All right. Well, I'm really delighted to introduce our third speaker of the day. We're sort of moving again up a little bit from soil to prairie and now to pollinators and critters. So I'm excited to hear this. And I'm delighted to introduce Augie Bergstrom, who is the station manager at the Monarch Research Project in Marion. He's a Cedar Rapids native who studied ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Michigan before taking on the role of station manager. The nonprofit organization was established in 2015 to restore and rebuild green infrastructure to support the monarch butterfly and other native animal life in the local ecosystem and community. Augie is a knowledgeable ambassador for monarchs and native plants who frequently gives informative presentations about the butterfly's life cycle and how to protect and build habitats. Augie is also a new Linn County Master Gardener, yay, and a coordinator of the new Monarch Research Project's Native Oasis pilot program. Please help me in welcoming Augie.
All yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. So I'm going to go through the monarch life cycle here to start, and then I'll transition to milkweed for a bit, and then talk a little bit about rearing. There's a surprising number of folks that rear, so always like to give a few tips towards the end. This has kind of been covered. Thank you very much. All right, we'll jump right into monarchs. So I'm sure many of you know, probably since the second grade, how a butterfly life cycle works, but there's some interesting aspects of the monarch, so hopefully you learned something new. But every butterfly has four stages. We've got egg, larva, pupa, and adult. In the monarch, that lasts about a month, 30 to 32 days, but can be very dependent on temperature and food availability. So, you know, especially in the caterpillar phase, the larval phase, the warmer it is up to a certain threshold, the faster they'll eat, the faster they'll metabolize, and the faster they'll reach butterfly. And then on the flip side, if we hit into the 60 degrees, they're going to go a little slower. At the station, I've seen it as slow as 36 days and as fast as 28 days. So there is quite a bit of range there. But we start with the egg. So the egg stage is 4 to 5 days. On the left there, we have a newly laid monarch egg. You can't see anything yet developing inside. But then towards that fourth and fifth day, you start to see that black spot, which is the head of the baby caterpillar in there. And when you see that, you know that within 24 hours, it's going to close and emerge. So to get an egg, we have to lay one. Here we're at the station in one of our rearing tents on the left. Female monarch has grasped onto a milkweed leaf and it's starting to curl its abdomen. We call it the egg laying posture. You can see in the right, it's curling up under the leaf. If you ever see that in the wild, you can be pretty sure that there's a egg hidden somewhere there. So they're almost always laying on the underside of the leaf, and they think that's for a few reasons, mainly protection from the elements, rain and wind. If that little egg or that real tiny first instar caterpillar falls off the plant, it can be pretty difficult at that size for them to get back up. So they're a little protected from that. They don't tend to bask in the sun. If you find a caterpillar, it's almost always, even at large stages, under the leaf. So they're maybe hiding from direct sunlight, and then predators. There are predators, especially before they start eating the milkweed a lot and developing some of that toxicity. There are some predators that will go for the small egg or even the caterpillar. Those being spiders, ants, even ladybugs will try to get to them. And then there's also a theory that the top of the leaf is harder than the bottom, so maybe that very, very small caterpillar with small mouth parts has an easier time starting to eat the leaf if they're eating from the underside. So here's our larval stage. That's a first instar monarch caterpillar just emerged. If you know what a monarch caterpillar looks like, it doesn't look like that. First thing it does, first nutrients in life, is the eggshell. So it turns around and it will typically munch that eggshell all the way until you can't see it anymore. So if you see a caterpillar, you're never really going to find the egg that it came out of. If it doesn't eat it, something else likely will. And then it's going to move on to the milkweed pretty quickly. So larval stage is about 2 weeks. Again, this is one of the time periods where it's very variable to temperature and how fast it's eating and metabolizing. But on the left, we do have 5 distinct stages of growth within this larval stage. We call them instars. That real small one up top is a first instar, then from the bottom, second, third, fourth, and then that middle one is your fifth. So as they eat, they're obviously growing, but their skin isn't. So there's a series of moltings that distinguishes those 5 stages. So 4 moltings creates the 5 instars. On the left, or on the right there, we have probably a 4th instar caterpillar munching away, and again, from the underside of the leaf. Now this stage is pretty vulnerable to what I like to call monarch menaces, and there's 2 really nasty ones. They're parasitoids, so they're killing their host, killing the monarch, and that's the tachinid fly and the calcid wasp. They have very similar life strategies. They're often injecting their eggs into either the 5th instar caterpillar or even the chrysalis when it's just formed. Those eggs develop into larvae. Those larvae eventually come out and destroy the caterpillar. On the left one there, the tachinid fly is particularly nasty. The first larva out creates a string typically to the ground, and then the other 19 or so follow. And yeah, not fun stuff. Then we have OE, which I still don't know how to pronounce the official scientific term. But it's more elusive. It's a parasitic spore. You can't see it with your naked eye. You have to use a microscope. And essentially, it weakens the monarch. So you most often see this in its emergence from the chrysalis. If it's infected with OE, it won't be strong enough to emerge out of that chrysalis in a timely manner a lot of the time. So instead of spreading its wings and drying normally, it's going to dry all small winged and crinkled and effectively can't fly, can't find nectar, and certainly can't migrate. So it's indirectly killing them, essentially. Then we get to the J, which is another very vulnerable time. This is just after we've reached 5th instar and they've eaten a little more milkweed and feel it's time. In that J, they're forming the chrysalis underneath the skin. This is a big difference between moths and butterflies. That butterfly, or that chrysalis, is being formed on the inside of the skin, and eventually, after about 24 hours, it's going to shed that skin to reveal the chrysalis. Whereas a moth, a lot of times, spins a cocoon on the exterior. It's interesting, this is almost never happening on the milkweed. Unless you're in kind of an artificial environment where there's not much room, you're really never going to find a chrysalis hanging on milkweed. We've got a fence line about 30 meters at the station, 30 meters from any milkweed, and we oftentimes see chrysalis just lined up on this wooden fence line. So they'll travel good distance on the ground to find something suitable. And it's not exactly known why, but it's thought that maybe they are trying to find something a little more sturdy, some sort of woody plant. We see them on bushes. Oftentimes we see them on houses. We see them on fence lines, something where they won't be blown over. Potentially less vulnerable to predators. Predators who want to find a caterpillar or a chrysalis are going to go to milkweed. That's where they are. So maybe in this vulnerable time, they are heading off away from that. Okay. So this was captured, I think I took this spring of 23 in the lab. So this is after it's hung for about 24 hours in the J. A little longer, probably 3 minutes or so. So that's about 15 seconds, obviously very sped up. I like to explain it as a kid trying to take off their shirt without using their arms. They're just kind of like, it's kind of like a jig in real time. Let's play it one more time here if we can. So if you notice, the chrysalis, if you know what a monarch chrysalis looks like, it doesn't quite look like this one here. when they first reveal it, it's very soft. And so there's about 24 hours, 12 to 24 hours where it starts to harden off and become that stereotypical chrysalis. Okay. So there's our chrysalis, and it's going to be in there for about 10 to 12 days. So similar amount of time to the larval stage. That's about 24 hours after it had hardened off. And essentially, they're really melting down in there. There's essentially goo inside the chrysalis. Now, they do have some butterfly structures, even as a fourth and fifth instar caterpillar. They have leg structure, wing structures developing, but a big portion of their body is melting down and reforming. If you have ever looked at a monarch chrysalis, there's gold dots all over. There's a line of them up top and then usually four at the bottom here. Those are spiracles. That's how the monarch is getting oxygen as it spends its 10 days in there. Then we get to the emergence. So on that 9th, 10th, 11th day, you're going to start to see that chrysalis turn black. You're starting to see the butterfly inside, and the chrysalis becomes extremely clear. It's thinning, and then it emerges oftentimes early morning, so it can use that peak hours of sunlight to dry off. So if you can see that third image in that line there, the abdomen is massive. The wings are rather small. It's pumping fluid from the abdomen into the wings, and that's how you get the expansion of wings. And so oftentimes when they have OE, they're not able to get out of the chrysalis to do that properly, and you get wings that dry that size. They're going to hang like that almost always on the chrysalis until they've almost drip dried, essentially. Then they'll start to slowly flap their wings, and eventually they're ready to fly. So on the right, there's a fully emerged female monarch. It was still a bit damp. That's why it's resting on my hand. It's not quite ready to fly, but it was flapping at that point. And they're going to live 2 to 4 weeks, typically. 6 weeks if they're in captivity. So here's a little identification. We've got a female on the left, a male in the middle. There's two pretty distinct differences on the wings. Can I hear a couple from you guys? Dots on the male. You've got two black dots on the hind wings that are on the veins. And there's one more. Yep. So the viceroy is a native butterfly to Iowa, but it's a natural mimic of the monarch. And the main difference there is that horizontal vein that's perpendicular to the vertical veins. And then, but the female monarch there has thicker veins than the male. That's another telltale sign that you've got a female. And obviously their reproductive organs on their abdomen are different, but if you're not holding them, you'll never be able to see that. It's also thought that the viceroy has a different flight pattern. The monarch kind of has a more flowy pattern going from plant to plant, while the viceroy is lower, more rapid turns, a lot harder to catch. A lot of times we're trying to catch a wild monarch to increase our genetic pool in the lab, and I'll run through the prairie, get cut up, and it ends up being a viceroy. So I have not been able to tell the flight pattern, but supposedly there is a difference.
If it's a little more open and you're watching them fly, they do look different. Well,
I'm glad you've seen it. And then we get to really the most unique aspect of monarchs is migration. And to be able to do that, they have to undergo what we call reproductive diapause. So we're going from a 2 to 4 week lifespan to a 7 to 9 month lifespan that allows them to undergo this migration. And that is sparked on by environmental cues that are changing their genetic expression. Those happening in the fall, like shortening of the day, decreasing temperatures, milkweed is starting to go to seed and decay, and lower nectar, just less things in bloom. Those things tell them that we shouldn't be producing eggs and spermatophores. Instead, we need to spend our energy producing proteins and fats that will allow us to sustain a long flight. So here's our migration. We start late summer, early fall. Here, that's late August and September. We're starting to see monarchs flying through, and our monarchs are starting to leave. We're going to get to Texas typically in October and November, and then eventually the first arrivals into Mexico, the ones that are leaving from closer areas, get there in early November, but there are monarchs coming in up and through into December. So it can be up to 3,000 miles. Monarchs are coming from Canada, New England, quite a journey. And there is this western population on the left there that is summering in California and northern Mexico, and overwintering in California and Mexico, and then summering in the Rocky Mountain area. There is a little bit of evidence that they interbreed. They are the same species, but it doesn't happen often. Those Rocky Mountains are a pretty solid divide between the two populations. So to get down there, we're traveling by day, 50 to 100 miles traveled per day, 10 to 30 miles per hour, so they are picking up speed. They're usually around 1,000 feet in the air. That's very variable. They're coming down a lot to get nectar and then moving on. So throughout that journey during the day, they are stopping to get some energy. Then they're resting at night, and they're usually resting at what we call roost sites, which are conifers, any foliage that has, or any plant that still has foliage through those colder months that allow them to stay warm at night, as well as maintain some of their humidity. And what's really cool is oftentimes these are return sites. So there's a gentleman in Anamosa that was on the news last year, and he bought a property 3 years ago, and every year since buying it, he's had thousands of monarchs in his forests in the fall. So it's odd how they know how to come to the same spot. It's not the same monarch year after year, obviously, so pretty interesting genetic trait. So they're going to the Oyamel fir forests, which is a mountainous region in Mexico, central Mexico, about 3,000 meters above sea level. It is the perfect environment for them to hibernate. It's about 32 to 60 degrees, and so that's warm enough that they're not dying to freeze, and cool enough that they're not getting excited, flying around and wasting energy and coming out of that hibernation state. Then in February, as we start to breach 60 pretty consistently, that diapause is going to end. And because they're all in the same location, very similar area, very low opportunity cost to mate, so they're going to go ahead and mate and then start heading north at least by March, but it can happen in February. So just to kind of summarize here, we've got that fourth generation that starts the migration in the fall. They're migrating down, hibernating, and then mating. Then that fourth generation is going to start to come up, and usually in the Texas, Oklahoma area, they're actually going to start laying their eggs. Milkweed is already coming up at that time there, and that offspring is what finishes the journey, and that's what we call generation one. So that offspring is going to populate those northern states when it's time, and eventually second and third generations come along in those states. They populate even heavier, and then that fourth generation is hopefully large and migrates back down. So it's never the same monarch 1 year to the next. You're never going to see any overlap between them. Unless, of course, you're in Texas. So here's our 30-year history of the monarch population. They record it by area inhabited by monarchs because they're going to such a similar area. They're able to just measure the total area that those monarchs are inhabiting, and then we get our our data. So the y-axis is hectares. There's about 2.5 hectares or 2.5 acres per hectare. And then that x-axis is your season. So as you can see, pretty average, steady decline over the last 30 years, culminating to last year, we had 0.9 hectares inhabited, which is about 2.2 acres. So really too bad, but why is it happening? Two reasons, really, one of them being the loss of native habitat, loss of milkweed. Milkweed is the only thing the female monarch will lay eggs on, the only thing that the caterpillar will eat to develop into a monarch butterfly. So that's really the main issue is herbicide-resistant monocropping in our rural areas. We don't have milkweed in our rural areas. And then urban sprawl is also a factor, putting in concrete, putting in bluegrass instead of nectar source plants and milkweed. So what it leads to is habitat fragmentation. We have just these little spots where either milkweed has survived or we've planted. And so the female monarch has to travel further and further to find a suitable place to lay eggs. And therefore, in that 2 to 4 week lifespan, they're laying fewer eggs. The other side of this is climate-related conditions and events, especially on their migration. It's a long journey. They're very sensitive to any abnormal changes. So when you see these big drops in population year to year, it's almost always due to some sort of climatic event that has happened. So 1997, we had our largest recorded population in history, recorded history. And then that following year, we had our largest drop. And really all that was, as that fourth generation was traveling up to Texas, Oklahoma, started to lay their offspring, we had a real late freeze roll into Texas. And it took out not only a lot of adults, but also some offspring that had been laid. 2013, we had our lowest on record, 0.67 hectares, and that was sort of the opposite. Temperatures were higher than usual when they were hitting Texas. Instead of stopping there and laying eggs, they just kept going, and completely normal freezes in those northern states took out a ton of them. So that is a huge factor that causes these big swings. So to kind of summarize, we have the large drops due to the climate, and then sort of this average decline in peaks. And that's due to native habitat loss. So I like to think of it as native habitat loss lowering the ceiling. Even if we have perfect climate conditions, we're only going to get so much of a bounce back because we don't have the native habitat to support large populations. Good thing is we can do something about it. Impacting the climate, we can do things, but it's less tangible in our daily lives. So we always point towards planting native habitat, planting a diverse spread of native habitat, but also making sure that milkweed is involved. So I'm gonna transition here into some milkweed. Any questions on monarch life cycle?
Yeah. You said something about toxicity. I never heard of that before.
Yeah, so they do develop slight toxicity, but it's mainly just shown through their coloration. They're not very toxic, but their coloration shows that they might be. Very rarely.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And that's why the viceroy is mimicking the monarch, because they think they're a little safer. So they've been spending about 2 million years together, milkweed and monarchs. Which is really awesome. They can consume the toxic milkweed. They're not, so it's the sap that is toxic, and they are actively avoiding it. Those 2 million years have allowed them to adapt to it. Large caterpillars can consume the toxic sap, but they try their best to avoid it. So one really cool adaptation, you can see the leaf that this caterpillar is on is kind of kinked, like a hose at the top. So before they started eating that leaf, they chewed off that stem and essentially stopped the flow of sap, so they can eat that leaf without sap coming out towards the bottom. So it's really awesome. They are able to utilize this plant, but because they only utilize one, they're obviously paying for that. So we've got a lot of milkweed, over 70 native to the United States, but only some of those are native to Iowa or even the Midwest. These are some of my favorite non-native, just to show here. Heart-leafed milkweed. It's got a heart-shaped leaf, and then this really funky purple seed pod. Typically, they're green, as many of you probably know. Balloon milkweed, native to Africa. We had a couple of these in our office just for fun a couple years ago, and they do just have these massive hollow seed pods with these soft thorns. Then we have tropical milkweed, which is commonly used all over the United States and other countries. It's an incredible plant, grows quickly, has a very beautiful bloom, but there's some controversy over whether it should be used. Iowa State says it's okay. Here, the main issue with tropical milkweed is it will bloom and stay fresh long into the season, especially in these southern states like Texas, and it's thought that it is essentially negating one of those cues to migrate. So if they're seeing fresh milkweed late into the season, instead of going into diapause, they're just gonna stay where they're at. So it is used here. Iowa State says it's okay. My position on it is use it if you're gonna get rid of it come August. We use it at the station some, but we pull it out come late July, so we don't have any issues with migration. And it's also just better to plant native. You want plants that are coming back every year. So this is kind of the bread and butter of the native milkweed. These are what we use most often at the station and probably what's planted most often by the public. We've got common milkweed, which everybody knows. Anybody grow up pulling milkweed out of the crops? My mom is one of them. Yeah. She's come along. She's now planted milkweed, but I know it's a hard transition when you've spent hours and hours in the sun. So it's got a broad leaf, a ton of food value, a nice flower, purple flower. We've got swamp milkweed in the middle, the one we use probably the most at the station. A bit narrow-leaved, but it is taller, still a lot of food value. And a more pinkish flower. And then my personal favorite, butterfly weed, a much shorter, kind of ornamental if you're looking for something to plant that won't spread as much. Butterfly weed is for you. It's very dense, still has food value. My mom has a butterfly weed at her house and we find caterpillars on it every year. And it's got an orange flower. Diving a little deeper here, the main reason we use swamp milkweed is that main stock is coming back for a lot longer than the other species. So on average, swamp is coming back 6, 7, 8 years, whereas your common milkweed is 3 to 4 years, same with your butterfly weed. Obviously, they are self-seeding and they're rhizoming underground, but that singular stock, if you want it in a specific location, will come back longer if you go with swamp milkweed. On average, well, my boss's property, he has 6, 7 foot common. I haven't gotten that at the station yet. Usually it stops coming back before it gets to that height, but mine are around 4 foot at the 3 year mark. Yeah. World milkweed, it's our most widely dispersed milkweed here in Iowa. People don't really identify it very often. It looks quite a bit different. It's got a very thin leaf. And white flower, still something to plant. It will spread like crazy, just about as, if not the same, if not worse than milkweed, common milkweed, and it's got a white flower. If you look, you'll find it in ditches. Prairie milkweed, this seems to be a bit more rare in my subjective opinion. We do see it in our prairies, even though it wasn't seeded. Looks a lot like common milkweed, but we don't get it nearly as frequently. In our area.
What's the difference? How would I know?
It's got that red vein. And the flower is slightly different shaped and a little lighter.
Mine's a lot shorter.
Yeah, yep, and shorter. Yep, the ones I've found are 2 foot max. Yeah. And then purple milkweed, which I've only really put it in here because if you want something to plant in your property that is very fragrant, the purple milkweed is known for having a nice smelling flower. And I'm just going to touch on growing milkweed. It is quite simple. People are usually trying to get rid of it because it's growing too well. But if you're planting by seed, just like many native plants, 1/4 inch under the soil. If you're planting by seed, they need to be stratified, just like many natives. 2 to 3 months is ideal, 3 months if you can, 45 degrees or less. The fridge works okay. Obviously, if you can mix in some moist stratification, the way we do that at the station is taking a plug tray, filling it with soil, putting our seed just below the soil line, and then throwing that in a garbage bag. So we're not getting eaten by the rodents, and we're also able to open up that garbage bag, spritz it, keep the moisture level high, and it's still getting that freeze and breaking up that seed defense a little bit. Planting plugs, we plant around 3,000 plugs at the station every year. It is brutal work the last 3 years or so since I've been there, really. You're going to want to water just like many other plugs. You got to water them every day, especially those first 3 weeks if we're seeing no rain or even high heat with some rain. And then don't waste your time watering established milkweed. Once it hits that second year, you're just wasting your time. It is very, very hardy. Okay, how am I doing on time here? Okay, I'm gonna blitz through rearing here. Does anybody rear in the room? Is this a waste of time? Carolyn? Okay, well, if you ever do go into it, these are important tips to know. The goal with rearing, we do it a lot at the station. It does help their success rate, the monarch success rate, but the main thing is you want to excite, inspire, educate folks on the connection between native plants and native species, insect species. And hopefully people are inspired to plant more natively if someone they know is rearing or if they're rearing themselves. So inside, in my opinion, a lot harder than outside. But the first thing you need is a clear container, and it's quite important that you have equal number of containers to the number of caterpillars you're rearing. If you have a large enclosure, that can be different, but if you're working with something small, don't put more than one in. You want something that's visible. You want to be able to see inside, see when you need to feed the caterpillar, see what's going on. If you're using some sort of enclosed thing, you absolutely need a ventilated top. They need to breathe. Bigger is better, but it's not essential. And then if you're using something that can act as a greenhouse, do not put it in direct sunlight or you're gonna literally cook your caterpillar. This is the best enclosure that you want. You just want something mesh and somewhat large. Airflow is your greatest ally when you're rearing indoors. Bacteria is your enemy. So if you don't have airflow, you're going to have bacteria buildup and things go wrong pretty quickly. We like to use mesh enclosures and we put a fan on to make sure things are drying. Filter paper or a paper towel. So this is a good example of how not to rear. This is multiple caterpillars in a very small environment and that enclosure is not ventilated. It is plastic. So frass, caterpillar poop, builds up very quickly. So at least here we have a paper towel that is catching all that frass and you can remove that paper towel daily and take the bacteria from the frass out of the equation. So it just allows easier, quicker cleaning. And another tip, you can spritz very lightly the paper towel and that will help whatever clipping of milkweed you're using to stay fresh and not dry out before it gets eaten. Spoon or paintbrush? We do not want to handle caterpillars with our hands, especially when they're in their first and second instars. They can be squished very easily and our hands are dirty. So we use a very fine paintbrush when we're moving caterpillars. It's as simple as a little swipe under their legs and then the reverse motion to put them back where we want them. Milkweed, so when you're indoors, this is the big crux of indoor rearing. You have to use clippings for the most part unless you've got a large enclosure with a plant in soil. So you're going out daily finding milkweed and clipping it. Obviously the number of clippings you need to gather is dependent on not only how many caterpillars you have, but the size of them. A fifth instar caterpillar is going to mow through milkweed as a first instar will hardly touch it. Big thing with collecting clippings is they have to be washed. We can have bacteria on those leaves. We can also have OE on those leaves. A caterpillar that eats a milkweed leaf with OE on it will ingest that OE, and then when it goes through its transformation in the chrysalis, you're going to have OE on the wings, and that's when you get all this weakening. We use bleach 5% solution, so a very light solution of bleach. We let it sit in there for 5 to 10 minutes, and then we do 6 or 7 rinsings to make sure we don't have any bleach left over. And then caterpillars. Obviously, you only need to search on milkweed. Underside of the leaf, like I said, they also like to lay eggs on the crown of the plant. Again, those leaves are very soft, so it's thought that those caterpillars, when they're very small, have an easier time munching on those. No real bias by the caterpillars on what milkweed you feed them. Whatever you have will work. There is evidence. Iowa State has gone through this. I haven't seen it personally, but when you swap the milkweed mid-larval cycle, sometimes they will not eat the new type of milkweed. So to be safe, you can keep it consistent and use the same milkweed. We do, based on our supplies, transition milkweed just because we've never had an issue, but Iowa State has been pretty clear that they do. You can start looking in late May, early June is probably the best time. Last year was a very brutal year. Just about anybody in the community that I spoke to couldn't find any. But if you want to start looking earlier, I think the first account I saw of a caterpillar last year was May 3rd. So they got here pretty early last year. But again, it's getting harder to find them. A couple notes, you do not want to move your enclosure when the caterpillar is in its J. It's its most vulnerable time. If that caterpillar falls off when it's in its J, it likely will not form its chrysalis, reveal the chrysalis. So if it's in its J, never touch the enclosure. Don't try to take out the milkweed leaves that are now probably wilting at the bottom. Just let it reveal the chrysalis and let it harden, and then it is very, very sturdy. We get chrysalis that fall all the time that have hardened, and we just pin them back up and they emerge perfectly fine. So just wait for that. And then when you start to see that chrysalis darken, you know it's going to come out in about a day. You need to watch it closely. The last thing you want, especially when you're working in a small container like this, is the butterfly to be fully dried and flapping around and hurting its wings. So it also doesn't have water or nectar in a small enclosure. You need to release it as quickly as you can. So just be vigilant when it's starting to get towards the end there. Okay, outdoor rearing. I'll just touch on this. It is, in my opinion, the much preferred method. We call it the Monarch Zone program at Monarch Research Project. Really, it's just a large tent, mesh tent, that is fine enough grade that it has insect mesh, that you're not allowing any of the nasty stuff to get in and harm your caterpillar. So pros, you can rear a lot more. There's ventilation. You're not using clippings. The plants are in the ground. And obviously, it's far more natural. Milkweed in the ground, tent over it, and then collect caterpillars if you can find them and put them in. So again, you're protected from these menaces. These are quite small. The tachinid fly is large, and it's pretty difficult to miss. But the calcid wasp is very, very small. If you don't have, if you have shade cloth instead of insect mesh, it will get through your holes, and it'll be pretty drastic problems. And then OE, not a whole lot you can do. If you have a third grade level microscope, you can see it. At the station, we test every butterfly that we rear. We just take a piece of tape, very gently touch their abdomen, put that on the slide, and you can see here, those are the scales on the abdomen, the larger dots, and then the very, very small groupings of black specks, that is OE. Again, natural, so if you're working in a tent, rain is coming through. Butterflies do, if you're holding them, which you probably shouldn't, butterflies do need nectar and water. So if there's moisture involved, all the better. And they are getting migration cues if you're rearing outside in that time period. And then success rate skyrockets is the last note. It's less than a 5% chance that a caterpillar reaches butterfly in the wild. And then when we're rearing, our monarch zones report anywhere from 60 to 95% success. So it is a large jump. And finally, I'll just finish with, talked a lot about monarchs and milkweed, but the main take home is to plant as natively as possible, as diverse as possible, but just make sure you have milkweed involved. If you are interested in planting a little micro prairie at home, we have free seed at the Monarch Research Station up to 1,000 square feet, and that involves a couple species of milkweed and then all the great forbs and grasses as well. A little bit of the seed mix there. Common and swamp is what we have in for milkweed. And that's it. Thank you.
Speak to the toxicity to humans when you're handling milkweed?
Yeah. It's not really anything you need to worry about unless you are, you know, cutting and if you're getting clippings, you need to be very careful of that white sap. I would wear gloves. We had an incident two seasons ago. One of our staff was working with milkweed, touched their face, and within 10 hours it was completely swelled shut. So it is very toxic, wouldn't eat it, tastes pretty bad. I get a lot of questions about dogs eating it. From what I've heard from accounts, they will just throw it up. But that's usually a big worry. I have a dog, I'm planting milkweed, should I be worried? Usually they don't eat it, but in the accounts that I've heard, they just vomit it up. Yep, so.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Behavior of the caterpillar to chew the stem,
yeah,
and to stop the flow of the sap to the leaf,
yeah,
is a fantastic behavior. And it's, could you talk a little bit more about, you know, how insects acquire that behavior, how they transmit it, and why it's there?
Sure. Yeah. Well, like I mentioned, 2 million years of milkweeds trying to utilize milkweed. So it's ingrained in their genetics, but to explain evolution might take time. But essentially, they are the best ways of adapting to eating it survive. Obviously, if a caterpillar is eating sap every time they take a bite, it's not going to make it through. So over time, it has been able to adapt to that through many, 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 many generations. And there are a couple other adaptations. If they don't create that bottleneck at the stem, they will, if sap does come out, a huge problem is that sap sealing their mouth parts shut. So they are able to move it aside without touching their mouth parts and then continue eating. So there are several adaptations that they've been able to pick up through many, many years.
Yep. Are the red milkweed beetles a predator?
No. No, nothing to worry about. Nothing in research that says it, nothing that I've ever seen. They are extremely prevalent, especially at the station. We see them all the time, and we continue to rear with them on it, and it's not an issue, no.
Do they eventually kill the plant?
The milkweed beetles?
Right.
No. Your main issue there would be aphids, but it does take a whole lot of aphids to take down a milkweed plant.
My sister raises monarchs, and then last year she had a pretty good year, but sometimes they just die within the chrysalis. Do you think that's maybe because the leaves weren't washed and they got OE? And what about herbicides, if there's any herbicides? Is that going to kill them if you have a poor success rate of trying to grow them inside and they just quit growing?
Yeah, I'm not sure about herbicide. OE can weaken them enough in that process that chrysalis will turn black well before it naturally turns black. Other issues are bacteria. If those caterpillars are unusually black as they enter their chrysalis stage, oftentimes they don't make it through that stage. So I would, I guess, recommend ventilating. Bacteria is the number one issue with indoor rearing that I come across for people. Net, okay. So maybe add a fan as well, but you're not worried about, a lot of times if there's a parasitoid that has infected them, they'll turn brown instead of black. So I would guess it's bacteria or could be OE.
Is there any evidence that growing monarchs in an artificial environment is detrimental to their DNA or their, you know, the way that they are going to behave?
Yeah.
Moving forward?
Yeah. There have been a couple studies that have pointed to it, and then studies that have pointed against it. It's debated. I can say in my experience, we've been rearing for 8 years, but since I've been there 3 years, every year, you know, we're getting caterpillars, used to be from Iowa State, getting caterpillars in that have been reared in an artificial environment, and then eventually those caterpillars produce our migration, and we are tagging them, and we get a notification back from Mexico that they are getting down. So in our experience, that's not the case, but it is debated. Yep.
Thank you so much. Please give Augie a hand.